Hi, this is Jeannie Driscoll bringing you an episode of The Art and Soul of Healing. Today on the wings of Alliance for Natural Health, we will be traveling to Virginia Commonwealth University to visit with my friend and colleague, Dr. Alpha Fowler, who we affectionately call Barry. Dr. Fowler is the William Taliaferro Thompson Professor of Medicine at VCU School of Medicine. He not only has a clinic practice, but has had a basic research lab for a number of years with special interest in acute lung injury and vascular injury. Today, Barry will talk about his laboratory expertise that led to modeling cellular and molecular mechanisms that produce acute lung injury. He continues to be involved in clinical critical care medicine as an attending physician, where he cares for many patients with acute lung injury. We will also be hearing about his NIH-funded trial looking at sepsis and the use of intravenous vitamin C. I'd like you to welcome Dr. Barry Fowler. Thank you, Barry, for joining me on The Art and Soul of Healing. It's been great to reconnect with you.
Good to be with you.
Yes. So tell me, I've always been curious, how did you get interested in using intravenous vitamin C for patients in the ICU with sepsis?
Okay. Well, it all began with heart attack in the mouse. And we, at that time, this is probably 15 years ago, were designing a molecular way of limiting heart attack in the mouse. And we found that if we could boost one of the factors that happens in the heart when the heart has an attack, a heart attack, that we could limit the heart attack in the mouse. And so I had a very amazing molecular biologist working with me at the time, and you know Ramesh Natarajan. And Ramesh designed a small interfering RNA to prevent an important factor called hypoxia-inducible factor from being expressed inside the heart. And it attenuated the heart attack in the mouse. When we sent the manuscript with the studies to the journal, which was an amazing journal called Circulation Research, they liked the study, but they wanted us to show that if we reversed our protection, that it would cause the mouse to go on and have a heart attack. And Ramesh, circulating the literature, found ascorbic acid could reverse it. So we did the final experiments in the mouse, put it all together, sent it to Circulation Research, and they published it. We were then in the midst of moving our laboratory to a new building, molecular medicine research building here, and we were setting up models of sepsis, and we found that some of our findings had been duplicated in human studies in sepsis. And the question was, could we inhibit that in sepsis? And Ramesh walked into my office one day and he said, let's try ascorbic acid. And I can remember to the very day we set up an experiment where we were producing sepsis in the mouse. And the way we did it was we simply went to a mouse cage, pulled a bunch of pellets, fecal pellets out, put it in a 50 ml tube, sonicated the tube so that it was just sort of a greenish-brown gemisch, then centrifuged that very hard, and took off the supernatant, and the supernatant we put in another sterile tube and left it in the refrigerator overnight. We came in the next day, and we had five mice that would become septic and five mice that would be septic but would be given intraperitoneal ascorbic acid. And so it was like 4 o'clock in the afternoon. We put a tenth of an ml intraperitoneal into the control mice, which were the septic mice with no treatment. and we put the same 10th of an ml of that septic solution we call the stem solution. But we followed that with 200 micrograms per gram of body weight in the mouse. Closed the cages up, went home. I'm always at work at 6 in the morning, and I was rushing to work thinking, okay, all those mice will be dead. Mm-hmm. And I got into the laboratory, turned the lights on, and in the control cage, all the mice were dead. And in the treatment cage, all the mice were running around drinking water and eating food. Mm-hmm. And that was really the beginning. We went on to conduct a number of experiments looking at how vitamin C was attenuating the inflammatory process in the septic mice. We also looked at how vitamin C was rescuing the lung of these mice because they all developed acute lung injury. And we did a number of studies where we would perform bronchoalveolar lavage in these mice and showed that vitamin C could control the injury in the lung and attenuate the formation of edema in the lung. And then finally, we looked at cytokine and chemokine and inflammation in the mouse. The vitamin C totally dropped that level of inflammation. And the other important thing is it dramatically increased alveolar fluid clearance.
Okay.
I'll never forget, Ramesh walked into my office one day and he says, this needs to go into the hospital. Mm-hmm. Designed a small trial giving patients high dosages of intravenous vitamin C where they would get 50 milligrams per kilogram of vitamin C infused every 6 hours for 96 hours.
And how did you choose that dosing regimen?
Literally off of our mice studies. So it was 200 micrograms per gram of body weight in the mouse. And we just said, what the heck, let's go with 200 milligrams per kilogram per day in the human. Mm-hmm. Divided it up, and it turned out to be 50 milligrams per kilogram administered every 6 hours per day for 4 days. And the reason we did the 4 days is I was a critical care doctor and we had a certain agent that we would infuse over a 4 day period continuously. And so we just said, what the heck, let's go with 4 days.
Mm-hmm. We'll come back to that because I have some questions about the 4 days, but did you have any concerns about cytokine storm in these patients using the vitamin C?
No. We didn't know what we were doing, honestly. Mm-hmm. Nobody had ever done this before. Nobody had ever given intravenous vitamin C to critically ill patients. And it was a small trial. We only had 24 patients in this little phase one trial. It was basically a safety trial. Mm-hmm. No ill effects. And from that small trial, about that time, the Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute at the NIH had announced a program asking for small phase 2A trials. And we submitted an application and got funded for $3.2 million to do a multi-center trial with that same protocol.
And I want to talk about sepsis a little bit, just to refresh everyone's memories. You describe sepsis as a dysregulated host response to infection. Explain that dysregulated response.
Okay, that's a great question. What happens in sepsis is that all of the immune response that someone who's going to have trouble with sepsis, not everybody has trouble with organisms growing in their bloodstream. The majority of people do. And it causes a cascade of release of very important inflammatory mediators, whether there be cytokines such as tumor necrosis factor, interleukin 8 and other inflammatory cytokines such as IL-6, which is a master cytokine, are important chemokines that will promote movement of acute inflammatory cells like white blood cells, as well as promoting an unrestrained inflammatory response that causes damage to the capillary network of the body, most importantly, the lung. When that capillary network in the lung is damaged, basically fluid moves from inside the vascular space into the dry air space of the lung and basically produces a drowning effect of the patient who is not treated properly.
Okay. So the multiple organs are involved, though. I think that's important. And you use something called SOFA score to measure organ dysfunction. Can you tell us about the SOFA score, and are people still relying on the SOFA score?
SOFA is an acronym that stands for Sequential Organ Failure Assessment Score. And what it is, it examines six body systems: respiratory system, cardiovascular system, the cerebral system, the hematologic system, the renal system. And what it is, it allows you, according to the severity of each organ injury, to just simply apply an objective number to that. And a normal SOFA score in an adult human is 0 to 1. And in the patients that we study frequently in intensive care, SOFA scores can vary into the teens and even into the low 20s. And it simply indicates the onset of acute multi-system organ failure.
Oh, my. So why is sepsis increasing so much, the incidence increasing so widely?
Well, first of all, our population is getting older. People like Jeannie Driscoll, who were treating cancer patients for years, are inducing profound immunosuppression to be able to kill tumor. Patients who have genetic diseases, all of it equates to an increase that has occurred gradually over the past 25 years.
And why is the death rate so high with sepsis?
The death rate is high because we have now a generation of critical care doctors who can handle antibiotic administration very well, who can handle the cardiovascular collapse of patients with sepsis very well. And despite that, there's still a very high mortality, sometimes varying from 45 to 50% of patients admitted with severe sepsis who ultimately will die.
And then a part of this syndrome is ARDS. So what is ARDS and why is it so hard to treat?
As we showed in the mouse, sepsis promotes injury to all the delicate capillaries in the lung. And what happens during this period of time, sepsis leads to a very dramatic activation of the immune system, which then leads to a very significant activation of white blood cells that's inappropriate for the amount of infection. And that ends up damaging capillaries throughout the body, but very importantly, the lung. And what happens is the barrier function of the lung that keeps air on one side and blood on the other side gets damaged, and the water and cells from the bloodstream will flood into the lung and produce acute respiratory failure. What's made it difficult to treat is that when you're applying techniques to prevent the lung from shrinking because it's inflamed and loaded with water, that you have to very precisely ventilate a patient in respiratory failure, or the support will produce more respiratory failure. So there's a very fine line that a critical care doctor plays while they're supporting somebody with lung injury. It's been studied now. The first identification of it was reported in human beings back in the 60s. And since that time, we're now 50 years into trials and therapies, because we know a lot about the molecular way that the lung injury occurs. And with that knowledge, there have been dozens, even hundreds of trials trying to attenuate the lung injury at a molecular level, hoping to improve survival.
Well, I want to expand on sepsis a little bit more. There's increased reactive oxygen species, nitrogen species, and this results in a very potent cytokine and chemokine expression, which you mentioned. What do these do to the glycocalyx of the endothelium, that lining of the vascular system?
What an incredible question, and let me elaborate on that. One of the things that has been shown, and this is important, I won't go into extensive detail, but one of the important things that's been shown is that the gel-like layer inside the blood vessels, called the glycocalyx, is damaged, severely damaged. And as the glycocalyx is damaged, here comes a little molecular talk now, it causes exposure of certain molecules called receptors that are mediating sticking of circulating activated white blood cells. And what happens is, as the glycocalyx becomes damaged, especially in the lung, that these adhesion receptors basically grab activated neutrophils that are activated to generate reactive oxygen species and hold it very close to the vascular surface, and that damages the vascular surface. The other thing that's very important is this horrible cascade and body-wide activation of white blood cells literally causes the blood cells to explode and disgorge their genomic DNA along with their active enzyme systems. And it's been shown that if you go to the bedside of a septic individual and you simply draw blood and analyze for cell-free DNA, that the higher the DNA, cell-free DNA in the circulation, the higher the mortality.
Okay. That really makes sense with those leaky vessels and enhanced vascular permeability. Well, knowing all of this science, this really hasn't led to a cure and a reduction in mortality. And so we're back to your use of intravenous vitamin C. You correctly understood why oral vitamin C could not be used. Why is that?
When vitamin C is taken orally, the design of the GI tract is that it has a certain vitamin C receptor that will not permit high-level absorption of the vitamin C into the bloodstream. And it's been clearly shown in many studies, very important studies that were done at the National Institutes of Health by Dr. Mark Levine in his laboratory, that you can give people grams of vitamin C and it does not substantially raise the plasma level of vitamin C. Whereas if you give the vitamin C intravenously, you can get very, very high plasma levels, even into the millimolar range and even higher.
And how do the body stores of vitamin C? They're often low, I think, in critically ill patients. At least I think in your patients they are. Did you measure vitamin C levels?
Yes, we did. Thank you for that question. In our first trial, well, let me back up. The normal plasma vitamin C level in a human being with a normal diet runs between 70 and 80 micromolar in the circulation. What we showed was in our first trial that the vitamin C levels in those septic individuals, which we measured, were down in the scurvy range, which was at or less than 10 micromolar. And so it's very important. It's been demonstrated in a number of trials that vitamin C levels trickle down to very low levels and that the patients who are developing sepsis, because of all the processes we've talked about, the reactive oxygen species formation, the high level of inflammatory mediators, that vitamin C is consumed at an abnormal rate, so that Mr. Jones, who had a normal vitamin C before he was septic, comes into the hospital with a critically low vitamin C level.
You know, evolutionary-wise, I wonder why these inflammatory cytokines negatively regulate vitamin C absorption, downregulate those transporters. I wonder why that is. Why wouldn't the body upregulate them?
That's a question for somebody far smarter than me, I will tell you. But if you look at the level of oxidant injury that's going on, you can see why sodium vitamin C transporter 2, which is very, very important for pulling vitamin C free out of the plasma into the intracellular space, are damaged by reactive oxygen species. And that has a lot to do with it, the vitamin being consumed.
So it's a damage effect.
Exactly.
Well, that makes more sense to me. One of my favorite things was your early research with Ramesh Natarajan, who mentioned, you just mentioned. I love that diagram that you had. I think it was 2016, you showed a beautiful diagram of the effect of vitamin C on the damaged alveoli. Can you describe what vitamin C does to this damaged complex?
Another great question. So one of the things, and I really miss Ramesh, he left us a few years back. Ramesh, incidentally, was an amazing molecular biologist. But what Ramesh and my just retired technician who worked with me for 38 years, Bernie Fisher, you met Bernie when we came to Kansas State University.
Yes.
As well as to the center in Corvallis, Oregon at the Linus Pauling Institute. That was great. Mm-hmm. But what Ramesh and Bernie, they did some very careful staining of septic lung. And what they were able to show is this cell-free DNA where the neutrophils literally are disgorging their DNA, that the lung becomes basically stuffed with this cell-free DNA, both in the intravascular space as well as into the air spaces of the lung. And this was totally attenuated in the mouse by high-dose vitamin C, simply given intraperitoneally.
It was a beautiful picture. I wish I could share it right now with everyone. Well, this led, after your animal trials, this led to the clinical trials. I want to go back to the dosing for 4 days. Let's talk more about that.
Well, as I mentioned earlier, I'm a critical care doctor, and the rationale was, at the time, there was a drug that was being given for 4 days continuous infusion to treat sepsis, a drug that subsequently was taken off the market because there was an uncomfortable incidence of cerebral hemorrhage. And so it was me designing the VCU protocol. That I just said, okay, let's give the vitamin C for 4 days. It was just that simple. There was nothing else other than that, because at that time I was giving this drug that was taken off the market, and we had had a couple of bad instances here. And so we just said, let's go with 4 days.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes. And have you ever considered lengthening that?
Yes, that is a great question. So I am working with the Prevention and Early Treatment of Acute Lung Injury Network. It's called the PETAL, P-E-T-A-L Network. And we are about to initiate a trial called the ASTER trial, which will study it'll be a three-arm trial that will study intravenous vitamin C using the VCU protocol, intravenous acetaminophen, which is a very bioactive molecule and has a lot of underlying proof to move forward in sepsis, and then a control group. And that trial will extend the vitamin C administration to 5 days.
Okay, I see. And how long are these patients usually in the ICU if they're going to survive?
That's a good question. Some never get out of the ICU. In our trial that we performed, the National Heart, Lung, and Blood sponsored trial, we showed that intravenous vitamin C had patients treated with intravenous vitamin C got out of the ICU significantly faster than patients who were control patients simply treated with standard of care.
And that was that the Citrus Ali trial?
Yes. And in that trial, the important findings were, as I just mentioned, patients got out of ICU faster. We showed at 28 days that intravenous vitamin C significantly lowered the mortality from 47% to 29%.
Okay. Well, let's back up a little bit. How was the Citrus Ali trial set up?
Yeah, Citrus Ali, what the NIH wanted, the program that they announced was the UM1 program. Mm-hmm. And what they wanted was a phase 2A trial with a lot of basic data, which we supplied, along with our little phase 1 safety trial. They wanted a multi-center trial. They weren't going to give us a lot of money, $3.2
million. It's not very much.
go very far when you're designing a multi-center trial. But we were able to design a trial that included VCU as the lead trial, the Cleveland Clinic. I have a friend at the Cleveland Clinic who subsequently is now at the University of Cincinnati. He pulled in the Fairview Medical Center, a large medical center in Cleveland. I have another friend in Milwaukee, Dr. John Truitt, who brought in the Medical College of Wisconsin, as well as another in-town large medical center, the St. Luke's Medical Center. I have another friend at the University of Kentucky and another friend at Emory University. And those were the 7 sites that performed the Citrus ALI trial over a 4-year period.
Thank you, Barry Fowler, for that wonderful discussion about the use of intravenous vitamin C in sepsis and acute lung injury. We will continue next time where we have left off exploring the possibilities of use of intravenous vitamin C in sepsis. And a special shout out to Alliance for Natural Health USA for standing in the gap for our health freedoms and for bringing therapies like intravenous vitamin C to all of us. Go to ANH-USA.org and become a member today.